The Hard Shoulder with Kieran Cuddihy.
With the MG Hybrid and Electric range.
On News Talk.
Yeah, this is The Bookshelf, and joining me now to place his books on the Hard Shoulder bookshelf is Donal Fallon, presenter of Three Castles Burning History podcast. Donal, you're very welcome back to The Bookshelf. Your books, give us your first title. What have you picked?
Yeah, I feel like I'm being rewarded for bad behaviour here, because I can never come home without a new book. we are drowning in books in my house. So yeah, the wife was delighted to hear I'm doing this.
And do you like physical books?
I do.
Yeah,
I do. I can't read books on Kindle. No.
I've tried it. Yeah, I think you're either one or the other.
Yeah, 100%.
Yeah, 100%. I like the feel of a book.
So I've had a great time going through the bookshelf, saying what will I bring to this? And to the shock of friends, I didn't bring Ulysses. The first book is Ernie O'Malley on Another Man's Wound.
Wow. Okay. So who is Ernie O'Malley, first of all?
I mean, some people would say Ernie O'Malley's life is waiting for a Hollywood screenwriter. In a sense, that's already happened. We all love Ken Loach's movie, The Wind That Shakes the Barley. And Ken's talked about how this book is the real central influence in shaping that character, Damien. I thought that was a brilliant role. Cillian Murphy was totally in it. And like, the Irish Revolution produced an awful lot of memoir. We live in a very small country. Less people live on the island of Ireland than live in the greater London area. given the scale of Ireland, I don't think any revolution produced as many memoirs as the Irish one did. Some of them are great books and they went very far. You know, Tom Barry, Guerrilla Days in Ireland, apparently Che Guevara, loved that one. Dan Breen, My Fight for Irish Freedom. I love that the spine of Dan's book just said, Dan's book.
Yeah.
People are walking.
That's exactly what it
people
says
walking
on this.
Into the bookshops.
Yeah, walking
into the bookshops in Tipperary. Do you have Dan's book? We do. But this one that we're talking about today is something else entirely. I think Ernie O'Malley's memoir really just stands head and shoulders above everything else in that period. And, you know, John McGahern said about it, he said that the memoir was the one classic work to have emerged from the violence that led to the foundation of the state. That might be just a little bit unfair because the others are still good books, but definitely it's a book that transcends just being a memoir of a war. It's about being a young man in a moment of great excitement and your own life taking a very different course to what you intended it to be.
But tell us a little bit about him himself, like his own background, where he came from.
Yeah, I mean, Ernie O'Malley's background is classic middle class. You know, he's the son of a solicitor's clerk. He goes up to Dublin. Well, the family moved to Dublin, but he goes to study medicine at UCD, 1915. And then his life is transformed completely by the Easter Rising. And he writes at the beginning of this book about kind of stumbling on the Rising by total accident. He's just a young medical student walking through town. He's on Sackville Street and he watches the looting happening. And he writes, diamond rings and pockets full of gold watches were selling for sixpence and a shilling, and you were cursed if you didn't buy. Ragged boys wearing old boots, brown and black, tramped up and down with air rifles on their shoulders, or played cowboys and Indians, armed with black pistols, supplied with long rows of paper caps. Little girls hugged teddy bears and dolls as if they could hardly believe their good fortune. You know, imagine just walking onto O'Connell Street and hearing the breaking glass of the looters on one side of the street and watching the Declaration of a Republic on the other side. And I think for him, that changed everything. He's horrified by the executions. John McBride had been a family friend from Mayo. And he flunks university, just drops out of college. And he throws himself into the Irish Revolution with real passion. And he gets involved in reorganising, which is a big challenge after the Easter Rising, you know, reorganising the movement. Basically, he goes around Ireland on a bicycle.
Mm.
I always said a bicycle is one of the most important weapons in any revolution.
Because it's transport, but it's silent and you can get into places that you can't get into unseen.
How do you move documents? How do you move handguns across the country? The best way to do it, you know, is often on a bicycle. And his account of kind of going around Ireland, and sometimes it's mad stuff, taking part in raids on police stations, pouring petrol down a chimney of an RIC station and setting it on fire. Sometimes it's reflecting on the birds and the bees and the trees and the life of Ireland. It's a really, really fantastic
memoir.
You've
given us some of the passages out of the book, and some of them are like prose. Like, I mean, it's just extraordinary, the language in it. But it opens in quite a
So we have this kind of that kind of account of what it's like to see the Easter Rising. Then it gets very, very serious. And I always wondered, like, where did he write this book? Like, because he'd been in the losing side of the Civil War. He was very, very lucky to get away with his life. And I think when you're on the losing side of a civil war, you can do two things. You can look back in anger, as some people did,
or you can
get on with it. And that's what he did. He travelled. He went to France, Spain, Italy. During 1929 into 1932, he's in Mexico City and New Mexico. And that's where he writes this really extraordinary memoir. And I wonder, is it a better book because he wrote it with the comfort of distance?
A bit of detachment.
And Mexico was, you know, there were great artists and writers in that part of the world. He was a real modernist. He was interested in what was happening in art and literature beyond just kind of writing a heroic story about Ireland. So, I mean, this guy was friends with Jack Yeats. He was friends with Sam Beckett. He spent time in Paris with Samuel Beckett. He was great friends with John Ford, who made The Quiet Man.
I love this reference to him as well. So he has, like, The Quiet Man is a favourite movie of lots of Irish people. Tell us the credit that he gets in this.
We've all brought an American cousin on Pilgrimage to Kong, haven't we? But you watch it at to the very end.
Yeah.
You make it to the end of The Quiet Man in the credits. Ernie O'Malley's name appears as IRA advisor.
Wow, brilliant.
And apparently John Ford was staying in the Shelburne Hotel not long after Ernie O'Malley died, and there was a load of journalists on the steps of the Shelburne. And he said, I have a question for you guys. Was anyone here at Ernie O'Malley's funeral? So he really regarded him as something of a hero. And that memoir, for me, it's just a beautiful book.
Come here, tell me now, you chose this as your favourite book, and it's a very hard thing to do. I accept that, and we're going to go into some of your other choices as well. But I just know you're a guy who reads a lot. Would you return to a book to read it again if you liked it? Like, have you read this a few times?
Absolutely. Yeah. And I find myself kind of going back to it no matter what I'm writing about. I find there's something in that book for
Isn't
everything.
That amazing?
Like, there's a lovely line in it about social class where O'Malley says that the layers of class in Ireland are like the layers of an onion.
And some things
so
never
true.
Change.
Yeah.
So, look, it's very hard to pick just one book, especially for someone like you, a historian, who recalls all these details. So I know Kieran always lets people pick what might be their close second. What's your close second?
I mean, maybe when you're looking at one book, that influences the next one you pick. Because Ernie O'Malley's book ultimately is a book about a young revolutionary on a bicycle. And then the second book that I brought is called Rambles in Erin.
I was surprised by this one. I was surprised you chose this.
Amazing. Sounds, it's not a very Dublin book at all.
It sounds fascinating. Tell us about it.
Dublin's, most people think I haven't been further than Leixlip, which isn't true. Fallon is a very West of Ireland name, you know. But I'm completely in love with this book. And before Dervla Murphy or Mancon McGann, there was William Bulfin, who went on this journey across Ireland in 1902 on his bicycle. He called it his Wexford Wheel. And he claims that it brought him on 3,000 miles of curious journey across Ireland, forward and back. Even how it opens is beautiful. I was hungry for a feast of the summer glory, and I was filled with a desire to dim the workshop lustre on my brand new Wexford wheel. It was the last day of June, and the weather was perfect.
Wow.
It doesn't sound like Ireland, but it is Ireland.
Yeah.
And it's a really beautiful book.
And William Bulfin was a returning immigrant. So where had he come from? And what was it about that kind of returning thing that gave him, I suppose, that unique perspective again, like you say? He went away, came back.
Yeah, like half of Offaly, for whatever reason, the Bulfins went to Argentina. About 100,000 Irish people emigrated to Argentina in the late 19th century, which is mad. We never really hear about
them. No, you don't. No.
The way we hear about County Kilburn or Brooklyn. Che Guevara's people, probably the most famous example of Irish migrants in Argentina. But Bulfin comes back from Argentina to explore Ireland. And maybe, and we all know these people, and I won't name any names, my friends know who I'm talking about, fellas go abroad and they become far more Irish than they were when they lived here.
Oh, that's right. Absolutely. We hate the place when we're here.
As
we go abroad, we love it.
Yeah, yeah. Guys who say kick off, not throw in, talking about the All-Ireland final, you know. But they're Irish in exile. And Bulfin, I think, abroad is just drawn back to the old country. And he writes about it really beautifully, the people he meets on the side of the roads, all that kind of stuff. So it's a real moment in time book. I love, there's a moment where he meets a motorcyclist. Think about how new the motorcycle was.
Yeah, he must have been
in the early 20th century.
Blown away by that.
And the guy tells him, your ordinary bicycle is out of date. No sensible man would now go creeping around the country at the rate of 10 miles an hour when you could do 20 and 25 and even 30 miles an hour on a motorcycle.
Anyway,
so here's a nostalgic returning immigrant on his little bike travelling around the country.
He wasn't always impressed with the modern Ireland that he met. I love this phrase that he says, I saw thousands of well-dressed people hurrying to and fro with no flash of humour in their glances. Isn't that brilliant?
That's Belfast, which was a thriving industrial city, you know, with the Industrial Revolution. They built the Titanic in the docks of Belfast. And when he goes there, he's just not taken by it at all. You know, the noise of wheels and hoofs and cranks and spindles and steam hammers filled my ears and made my head ache. He doesn't want to see the dockyards of East Belfast.
Yeah.
You know, he wants to see Cathleen Houlihan. He wants to see the beauty of the West and the South of Ireland. And I think what's so nice about this book, it's just been republished this year. We can emulate it. You can actually jump on a bicycle and you can basically go on Willie Bulfin's journey.
I might jump on a motorbike to do it, but I don't think I'd be jumping on a bicycle. Oh yeah, that sounds like a fascinating recommendation. I'm definitely going to pick that up. Now, tell us what you're reading at the moment or what you've read recently.
I've kind of cheated here, right, because I've brought two books to this. One is...
Well, you've mentioned... I don't want to point this out, you've mentioned about 20 books so far. But anyway, you're reading one at the moment.
Yeah, so I just finished Suzanne Rack's book, which is called The Woman's Game, A History of Women's Football. And of course, that's been in the news and in recent times. That's a really fascinating story, the rise of women's football at the time of the First World War, because of course the men were off fighting in the trenches.
Yeah, yeah.
And you have 50,000 people watching women's football. And it became the genie in the bottle in some ways, that the Football Association really couldn't get it back in.
I was amazed at the numbers, and Goodison Park featured.
Amazing numbers. And even in this city, I mean, my mother grew up in Ballyfermot, or Ballyfireout as they used to call it. You had that explosion of women's football in Ireland in the 1960s, 1970s, and amazing female players from this city who went on to do quite well on the European stage. So, yeah, there was a team in Finglas back in the day called Suffragettes FC. What a great name.
And why
that
did
is.
You like this book? Just because it was different?
I just thought that was great. But the one I love, the other book that just edged it, is called More Than a Shirt, How Football Shirts Explain Global Politics, Money and Power.
Yeah.
What a clever idea for a book. Joey Durso wrote it. And instead of just giving you this chronological, the first jersey sponsor was this, instead, 11 chapters, each centering on a team. So, for example, Democracy's Limits. In that chapter, he looks at Newcastle, the Saudi takeover, and how, you know, they, for the first time in their history, ended up wearing a green jersey representing that Saudi connection. So, chapter on borders, where we meet Club Deportivo Palestino. I didn't know this. The world's largest Palestinian diaspora group outside the Middle East is in Chile. And how that shaped a football team, the jersey they wear and their culture. So just a really beautiful idea to take something as everyday as the football jersey. Most people listening to this will have a reproduction football jersey in the closet, and bring you on this amazing journey.
And I think it's something that's not reflected on enough, really, as sport becomes just so ubiquitous with money. Like, there is a socio-economic and political dimension to sport, and particularly soccer. I think a lot of it is forgotten in this country. You know, it's often the poor relation. But are there any Irish dimensions to that book?
Only in terms of Glasgow and the diaspora, Glasgow Rangers, and how orange came to be a popular away shirt colour for them. And then Celtic, of course, in the green and white, following on from Hibernian, the team that James Connolly grew up following in Edinburgh. They were the first ones in green and white. But yeah, we think about, you probably imagine that there's been sponsors on jerseys forever. Actually, a German club in 1973, it was a very controversial thing. They wore local spirit manufacturer Jägermeister on their shirt, and people were horrified. For some people, the beautiful game was being, you know, ripped apart by commercial elements.
Well, they're right. It was about to get a whole lot worse.
So the book drifts a little bit at times away from the shirts themselves into broader social history of football. But when it's focused, it's a really, really, really fantastic book.
And perhaps reminded you of a great jersey you might have had in your own childhood.
Don't we all?
What was your favourite? What was your first?
For me, I always think about Otto Glass, who used to sponsor St. Patrick's Athletic in our glory days in the late 1990s. Those big O'Neill's jerseys. I mean, they're basically GAA jerseys on soccer players.
Yeah.
Big baggy things by design. But it's an extraordinary, you know, Opal. We think about Opal.
The sponsors of the Irish team.
How synonymous are they with the national moment of the Jack Charlton era?
That's right, yeah.
Which is mad. Yeah. And now you see the bootlegged jerseys going around town. They always have Opal on them. So there's Irish design classics. I remember Guinness sponsoring Cork City. Thought that was really bold.
Yeah.
You know, the home of Beamish and Murphy's, putting Guinness on a jersey. And Cliftonville, in Ireland's oldest football team, I love their fluorescent away shirt sponsored by Kit Kat in the 90s. So there's been some Irish design classics. But other than our cousins in Glasgow, we didn't make it into this book.
OK, and, you know, Glasgow and Celtic Football Club just... so synonymous, I suppose, with lots of Irish supporters as well from here, everywhere, all around the country, but up in Donegal.
That's interesting. I mean, that's something that I think is so fascinating. The way Dublin and Liverpool are so connected by emigration and Donegal and Glasgow. Likewise.
Donald, I might be booking that for you, yes. Well, listen, I think they're all absolutely amazing recommendations for you. And I absolutely know that there's going to be people tuning in here putting these on their Christmas card list. Donald Fallon, thank you so much for coming in to us today. We really appreciate it.
The Hard Shoulder with Kieran Cuddihy.
With the MG Hybrid and Electric range.
Weekdays from 4 on News Talk.